Calling all small firm architects. It's time to tap into your full potential with Entree Architects Context and Clarity, where inspiration meets innovation. Hey, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my two favorite co-hosts, Jeff Eccles and Katie Kangas, as they bring together authors, experts, and thought leaders for electric conversations with entrepreneur architects around the globe. It's not just a podcast. It's a community where dreams meet action.
There is a simple equation there. And what for me, what that did, just doing that basic calculation, was it allowed me to compare what I had actually saved in my retirement accounts to what I thought a possible projected annual spend might be.
Artists are temperamental, so beautiful design is going to be a priority. When the job is done, we're going to actually need to live in the house, not live with the person who designed it. And so for me, the artistic skill, the architectural skill is most important. And so I would say like that would be 60% of it, if not more.
Gain insights to build a successful practice. Subscribe, engage, and let's redefine your future together. Join the Context and Clarity community, where every conversation adds to your blueprint for success. My name is Mark R. LePage, and you are listening to Entree Architect Podcast, where each week I speak with inspiring, passionate people who share their knowledge and expertise, all to help you build a better business as a small firm entrepreneur architect. Michael Grinnick, welcome to Entree Architect Podcast.
Happy to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you here. This is going to be an interesting conversation because I don't know a lot about the topic that we're going to talk about. And I just want to learn more about it. And I think there's a lot of listeners that are with us today that are probably in that same boat. So we're going to talk about those things that we may not know about that are really important and we should know about. Michael Grinnick is a practicing structural engineer at the engineering firm Le Mesure, based in Boston. And he has developed a breadth of structural design and management experience on many of the firm's most complex projects, ranging from educational and healthcare facilities to high-rise residential and office towers. Mike also spearheads Le Mesure's sustainability practice, in part by serving as chair of the Structural Engineering Institute's SE 2050 commitment program, which states all structural engineers shall understand, reduce, and ultimately eliminate embodied carbon in their projects by 2050. He's also the chair of the SEI, which is the Structural Engineering Institute's Disaster Resilience Committee. And so I want to talk about embodied carbon. That's a term that, you know, over the last 5-10 years, we've been hearing a lot about it. I'm a busy guy. I'm an architect. I'm an entrepreneur. I'm doing lots of things. So I never really focused on what this is. But as an architect, it's something that we should all know about. And this is something that Mike knows about a little bit, and he wants to share with us. And I want him to come and talk to us at a really sort of basic level. What is it? Why is it bad? And why is this something that we should reduce or ultimately eliminate in our world? We have control over that. And so, Mike, I want to talk about that. But before we do that, I want to learn more about you. I want to learn more about your life, your career. What inspired you to choose structural engineering? Who or what inspired you to get to where you are? What's your origin story?
So we can start way, way, way back to when I was playing under my deck growing up. I was probably 8 or 9 years old, and I was playing with Tonka trucks, and my neighbors and I, we would build these quote unquote cities. They were probably tiny footprints looking back, but and so I, you know, had a construction company and you know, quote unquote construction company, and we were, you know, digging and making these cities, and my mom at one point said, you know, maybe you should be an architect, right? And I said, well, what is that? And then I don't know how I figured it out, because there was no internet then, but I figured out that, you know, architect was the ones that designed the buildings, you know, made, you know, how it looks and the shape. And I was like, oh, that's pretty cool. But then I, you know, as I got a little older, I realized that they don't design like the skeleton of the building. And that was what, you know, really intrigued me a little bit more. And at the same time, I was developing this kind of appreciation for bridges, right? And so you can see bridges, you drive over bridges, and the structure is all exposed. And so, when I went to college, I went into the, you know, civil engineering department at Syracuse, and realized that I just loved structural engineering and the, you know, statics and understanding the equations and physics and all of that. And I was really getting into bridges. So it was really through bridges that I found sort of a passion for structural engineering. And then what I did is I went back to Tufts University to get my master's degree. And I met my thesis advisor there, who was a structural engineer, practicing structural engineer on buildings. And he started talking about earthquakes and how buildings are designed to resist earthquake forces. And that just like lit me up. So then I abandoned, but I sort of pushed bridges to the side. And I got really intrigued by buildings and how they behave during earthquakes. So that's what I ended up getting my master's degree in. But sort of fast forward in getting towards the embodied carbon side of things, I was working on a 2 million square foot development in Boston. Really cool. I mean, and from an engineering standpoint, I was just super excited. High rise buildings and kind of what all structural engineers want to work on. But it was around, you know, a couple of years into that project where I was also starting to watch a lot of documentaries on the environment and like even getting into things like agriculture, the impact of agriculture on the environment and all of that sort of stuff. So at one point during this project, which was starting to get on in years, and I was like, all right, you know, it was losing its like, I was, you know, excitement about the structural part. And then I started thinking to myself, what kind of impact am I having here? Like, what kind of impact does this project have? And it was around that time that I realized that, one, you know, to produce 1 ton of steel, you emit 1 ton of CO2 into the atmosphere. And I was like, this is a problem, because that particular project had 20,000 tons of structural steel on it. So yeah,
you start adding up the numbers.
Exactly. So then I started, that's when I really started to sort of throw my energy into understanding the impact of the structure and buildings and the built environment. And then it sort of, you know, took off from there. And that was about, you know, 2016, 2017, where I really dove into it.
Yeah. So let's start at the beginning, because at first I didn't know what that term meant, embodied carbon. You know, I understand carbon. I understand carbon in our environment is not a good thing. It's not helping things. But I don't understand what embodied carbon is. So let's get really basic. What is it?
Yeah, so it's what you would call the carbon dioxide equivalent of the production, the installation, the trucking, anything that's embodied within the building of a building. Okay. And so that is everything from initial raw material extraction. So you literally determine how much carbon dioxide equivalent is emitted at that point. And then you track it through the trucking of that material to, say, a rolling mill for steel. And then the rolling mill itself, how much energy is it burning to produce the steel, right? So there's a CO2 emissions there. Then you're trucking it to the site, which has a CO2 emissions. Then you're installing it at the site, and so on and so forth. So it's the carbon dioxide equivalent of all of the different processes to construct and eventually demolish a building. So it's the so-called embodied. It's embodied in the materials.
Yeah. That, when you look at it like that, it's unbelievable how impactful what we do is on the environment.
Yeah, it's true. And, you know, the challenge that we've been having now is that, you know, the world recognizes that we have to limit the CO2 emissions to the planet. But historically, no one's been really paying a lot of attention to the building materials. And so, you know, the focus historically has been on operational energy, right? And where that's coming from, the fossil fuel based energy sources and all of that. But what people are realizing is that it's only half the story. Okay, so if you take the total carbon of a building, half of it is operational, the other half is embodied. Okay, and so it hasn't been until the last several years that people have started saying, "Oh, geez, like we really ought to be paying attention to this." And oh, by the way, basically all of the embodied carbon emitted to the atmosphere happens on day one of the building. So it's a sunk cost. You can't do anything about it once the building is built. And so I always imagine that eventually the operational side of things is going to become so efficient that over time your operation will be zero, but you would have already had that sunk cost on day one. And just to put it into a little bit more context for structural engineering, half of all of the new embodied carbon of a building comes from the structure. And so now all of a sudden everyone's looking at the structural engineers and they're saying, well, what are you guys doing?
Yeah.
Right. And so there's been a huge ramp up in education and trying to understand this and how, you know, is it even possible to reduce it? And, you know, oh, by the way, the UN says that we have to get to zero by 2050, like total carbon operational and embodied in like 30 years. Okay. So it's a huge, huge problem and but also exciting at the same time. A lot of opportunities.
Right. It's that's a very interesting what you just said. So half of the carbon comes from operating the building, right? So many of us understand that, right? That there's energy going into that building, whether it's electricity or whether it's fossil fuels. It's by operating that building, there is an impact with carbon, and many of us are working at trying to make those. That carbon be reduced in sustainable energy and the way we design the buildings. And those buildings are becoming more efficient and ultimately will become, like you said, Mike, they'll be zero, right? That they will have zero impact in terms of carbon. And that's probably pretty easy to understand how we do that, right? How do we get there? But the other half is embodied. And what you just said was that means everything from digging it out of the ground to transporting it to a facility to produce it and then the production costs and then getting it from that facility to the place where it's going to be distributed and then from the distribution all the way to the place where it's going to be built. And then there's embodied carbon in the machines that build it and and it goes on and on and on and on and on. And then half of that embodied carbon is all structural. Right. So that's huge. Right. So it's easy to understand the first part. Right. The first half, the operational, really difficult now that we understand what it is. And we want to take that and go from that to zero in 30 years. How do we even start to reduce that? How do we build buildings without producing carbon? How do we reduce it and ultimately eliminate it?
So couple things. Actually, I just want to give a tiny caveat to when I said half of embodied carbon. That's based on a time scale up to 2050. If you stretch that time scale out another 100 years, then it would be less of the percentage because operational is longer life. But I just want to make that clear.
No problem.
There's several things to do. Number one, on the design side, you can attempt to make more efficient buildings. So just simply using less material. Okay. So an example of that for the architects would be, and I would plead with the architects listening, is that if you can avoid doing column transfers. Okay. So a column transfer, you think of a column, vertical element that goes from the top of the building all the way down to the foundation. Often we've seen like in buildings where like if you're doing a residential, but the lower level is retail, the column that comes down through the residential won't work for the retail space below. So often we'll put a transfer girder in there. So that transfer girder has to be very large and it's usually spanning a long distance and there's a lot of extra material. So just by trying to find ways to make the columns come straight down, you can have a much more efficient building. But that's only going to get you, a certain portion of the reductions you're trying to get. Then you look at from a system standpoint. Okay, so if I do a residential building, do I make it out of concrete? Do I make it out of steel? Do I make it out of mass timber, for example? Mm-hmm. And you kind of look at it holistically, and I say, well, I could do it out of mass timber, but I'm going to need more columns, which then, causes issues for mechanical systems and all of that. So you look at it holistically and you try to, at the very early stages, pick a system that is least impactful when considering a variety of other design considerations. But really what happens after that is getting into the materials themselves. So for example, concrete. All right, so concrete gains its strength with a combination of Portland cement and water aggregate. And that's, you know, that's where the strength comes from. It turns out that the production of Portland cement is responsible for 7 to 10% of the world's CO2 emissions, just using Portland cement. Okay. And if you think about, like, every yard of concrete has about 600 pounds of cement in it. And, you know, for every ton of cement produced, it's another 1 ton of CO2. But luckily, what we can do is we can use other products that are similar to Portland, have the same chemical reaction capacity that Portland has. And some of those would be byproducts of industrial processes. So, for example, you can take slag, which is from the steel production, is a byproduct of steel, or you can use fly ash, which is a byproduct of coal burning plants. And you can take those materials and replace the Portland in the mix. So we've seen an ability to reduce the embodied carbon of concrete by, say, up to 30%, just by replacing with those industrial products. There are also other products that are coming online where you can actually inject this CO2 into the concrete, okay, during the ready mix phase, when it's like just the wet consistency, and that will react with the limestone that's in the mix and actually produce a stronger concrete, which then in turn requires less Portland cement. So you can keep finding ways to reduce the Portland cement. And so, and those technologies, you know, that one is available. I would not say it's at scale yet, but slag and fly ash is definitely at scale, and we can do that. We've been doing that for years, frankly, but finding ways to go above and beyond what's typical is something that structural engineers and contractors and architects should be aware of. So right then and there, with today's technology, we can reduce the concrete impact by 30%. The biggest bottleneck is, frankly, who's the champion, who's going to be pushing for this, right? It's different than what everyone's used to, okay? So in the building profession, things tend to change slowly, particularly with structural engineers. And so you need to see test data, you need to see your results, and so on and so forth. But the biggest bottleneck is just who's going to be pushing it, who's going to be the champion, who's going to educate the design team and the contractors and the owners to take it on. So that, you know, concrete, that's one example. Another material that has tremendous promise is mass timber. So mass timber is basically engineered wood products, okay, that are, you know, glued together, and they have pretty substantial structural capacity. Okay, the thing with timber, as people know, is that when a tree grows, it's sequestering CO2 out of the atmosphere, and then you harvest it, cut it up, and then put that wood into a building, and it's basically that building is acting as a carbon sink. Okay, so you're storing CO2 in the building, and during the life of the building, another tree is growing to grab CO2 out of the atmosphere. And mass timber, there are some code challenges and adoption, but I will tell you that we, in the last couple of years, several architects are asking us, can we do mass timber? Can we do this out of mass timber? And the embodied carbon of a building with mass timber is significantly lower, and in some cases can actually be negative. Okay, it actually can be a true carbon sink. The caveat to all of that, unfortunately, is what happens at the end of life of this building. Okay, so all that timber that's storing CO2, if somebody for some reason decides to burn it all, the CO2 goes back into the atmosphere. Okay, so there are you know, that those are two examples, mass timber and concrete, where you can make substantial reductions in embodied carbon. I think again, the champion, who's going to be pushing for it, there are some cost implications that the owners have to be aware of. But we are seeing a groundswell of momentum in this area. So I'm pretty excited about the opportunity to make these reductions.
Let's take a break to thank our sponsors for their support of this episode. As architecture demand increases toward pre-pandemic levels and beyond, how are you and your architecture firm keeping up? RCAT is here to help. RCAT.com offers several free tools to help architecture and design firms like yours get work done faster. Use RCAT's powerful search engine to find the right products for your projects, and download BIM, CAD, and specifications right there on the same page, without needing to pay or register. It's free. RCAT.com also offers product videos, catalogs, green reports, product certification information, outline and short form specification generation, and so much more. Visit RCAT.com today. RCAT.com is your one-stop solution to help increase your productivity and get more projects done faster. That's RCAT.com, A-R-C-A-T.com. FreshBooks makes it simple to send invoices, post your expenses automatically, track your time for your whole team by project, and get organized with financial reports, communication, and notifications. My favorite feature in FreshBooks is the automated invoice reminders. I think sending invoices and getting paid is one of the biggest barriers to our success as entrepreneur architects. Who has the time? But if we don't send out the invoices, we don't get paid, right? FreshBooks makes it easy to send out your invoices and get paid fast, online, with a click of a button. And when your client doesn't pay you on time, FreshBooks will send them a friendly email reminder through a simple system that you control. Sign up for a free 30-day unrestricted trial and get ready for the simplest way to be more productive, organized, and most importantly, get paid faster. Go to entrearchitect.com/FreshBooks and enter Entree Architect in the How Did You Hear About Us section. That's entrearchitect.com/FreshBooks. Please visit our platform sponsors today and thank them for supporting you, the Entree Architect community. It's interesting. I mean, every time I have one of these conversations, it sort of opens up doors in my mind. And it really is just a matter of understanding, which is why I love having conversations like this at a very basic level. Just understanding what it is and why it's bad and how we can reduce it. You know, us as small firm architects, we're not going to be able to make it go away, right? We're not going to eliminate it from our planet, but we can have an impact on it. And just knowing that there is a better way of doing it, right? Your first suggestion was to just use less material, right? And so being aware of that and saying, okay, can we do it this way or that way, which is using more material? And making decisions like that,
right? And that is the, you know, if talk about low hanging fruit, I mean, that's the one that everybody can get behind, okay? Right. Because less material is less cost, right? Yep. It simplifies things. It just sometimes takes a little bit of extra work on the design side of things to make sure that these simplifications work with the program. I think sometimes, look, projects, your architects are going to notice. I mean, projects happen so fast these days. I mean, it's like go, go, go. And sometimes it just takes a few moments where you take a step back and say, okay, is this really the best approach? And just in those moments, you can find savings of different materials. And it does require more collaboration. I mean, you know, in more upfront thinking that sometimes we sort of are just in a mode where you're going, right? And so once in a while, if you step back and say, let's just have a take a minute here and check, does this make sense? Do we really need that transfer girder, right? Is there anything, anything we can do to eliminate that transfer girder? It can go a long way. You're right. And that's the mentality to have before you get into the complexities of new materials and whatnot. Use less. And I would also argue adaptive reuse is the way to go, right? So, we're here in Boston, there's several old buildings, okay? And so if you can find a way to not build the new building and just reuse the existing one, that's really, I mean, that would be ideal, all right? So modest upgrades to the building systems, and maybe you have to do some structural retrofits, but at the end of the day, from an embodied carbon standpoint, leaps and bounds better than building a new building.
Yeah. And I think it also needs to become part of our workflow. It needs to become part of our process, right? You had mentioned that this is, we're working really fast, doing things the way we've always done them. And that's because we have a workflow, right? That either it's very specifically designed workflow, or it's just the way we've always done it. And so this is the way we do it. When you design a building with steel, there's a way that we do it in order to just do it quickly, because that's the way we've always done it. And so by putting something into your design process that stops and says, okay, we should check this, make sure that this is the best way to do it from a carbon point of view, allows us to stop and think about, is there an alternative to doing this? Is there something that any, are there any processes or steps in your process as a structural engineer that you've developed in your own process to make sure that you're being aware of these things?
Yeah, so it's funny because I was just talking to an architect this morning, and she was mentioning, how frankly frustrating it's been for her to make headway on some of her projects on embodied carbon, specifically structural concrete. And so what I told her, I said, well, what we've had some success doing is at the design development phase, no later than the initiation of design development, we the structural engineer initiate a low carbon concrete kickoff call. And we require the CM, the architect, the sustainability consultant, us, and an owner's representative to be on the call. Okay. Because to your point about workflow, unfortunately, it's just not in the front of people's minds to think about low carbon yet. Okay. And so we've got to do it from day one. And the reason we have this conversation early is because there are several implications. Let's just say you went to an extremely high Portland cement concrete mix. So from a scientific standpoint, the concrete itself has a lower, what's called a lower heat of hydration, meaning, there's less heat generated. And so it might take a little bit longer for that concrete to gain strength. Okay. That might have schedule implications that if you are bringing this up at the bid phase or the start of CA, you're never going to get it in there. It's just too late.
Yeah.
But if you have the conversation up front early and say, well, if you use that high cement replacement mix here, there's, and the CM is on board. Okay. I understand. I can adjust my scheduling, my sequence of installation of the concrete. And actually over the long term, over the full schedule, it will have no impact. You can't have that conversation when they're digging the hole. It's got to be well up front. The other thing is like some of these admixtures to the concrete, like a slag or fly ash, might have an implication to either the finish or the look of the concrete. And so you want to talk to the architect up front and say, look, is any of this concrete going to be exposed in the final condition? Oh, yes, we have these, architecturally exposed concrete walls. Okay, well, there's something that you should know. When you put slag in the mix, it might give that concrete a slight white sort of tinge to it. Is that going to be okay, right? And so, again, you can't have that conversation when they're digging the hole. It's got to be up front. And so just to broadly answer your question, initiating these low carbon structural options early in the project and just informing everybody and putting it out there and having just getting it all out there in front of everybody and having those key stakeholders in the room is so important. And it may be that as an architect, you need to, maybe your structural engineer isn't into this just yet. Well, maybe the architect needs to identify who's going to be the champion to push for something like that, right? Or ask the structural engineer, hey, can we do this? Or have you looked into that? And so it's truly a team effort, but at the end of the day, you do need one person who's going to be, sort of pushing.
Yeah, it can't be a surprise, right? This has to be, the team needs to be on board with this, especially the client, right? The client has to sign off on this. This is something that's important. This is something that we're going to do because this is going to impact schedule. It's going to impact cost. It's going to impact design. It's going to impact everything. And if the client is not for it or surprised, which is even worse, you never want a surprised client. It's never a good thing. Then you have a problem. And so this has to be brought up very early in the process.
Yeah, I agree. And I would say the earlier it's brought up in the process, the least cost add it's going to be. Okay. The later you bring it up, it's, not to be cynical, but bids have been awarded and all of that. If you start asking for changes, I mean, it just won't be in a competitive bid situation. So you're going to get a big change order potentially. The earlier you talk about it, you bring up the owner, and I do want to say if the owner is the key, okay, the designers can be, I can go into a meeting and be chirping their ear off, but if they don't follow or they don't agree, it's never going to happen. And so what I think in the fast paced mode, people are rightfully focus on cost, right, and schedule, and you know that's obviously critically important. And so in those modes, sometimes they just push aside. Oh no, no, we don't have time to. But if you go that extra mile and try to convince them to have a follow-up conversation, grab coffee with them, you know, then they kind of, it sinks in, right? And so sometimes it takes a few attempts. And actually, I just want to balance this all with the fact they're starting to come to us now. So like the last several years, it's been like the designers and the consultants maybe pushing, but we've actually seen more now owners, because they're all starting to get it and they're all starting to pay attention. So the other sort of side of the coin is that as an architect or a structural engineer, you need to be prepared now. It's no longer about just finding the energy to convince somebody. It's like, well, no, what if they came to you with questions? Are you ready to answer them? So it is happening very fast, as you said. So the industry is just it's trying to respond, you know, and I would say the last couple of years and probably the next few years will be a little messy in terms of trying to get this into the regular workflow, but I'm convinced it'll be there.
Yeah. And what I also will find interesting are the innovations that will be developed because of this, right? You're talking about innovations in concrete development. That'll happen all over, right? You're seeing that in solar development. You're seeing that in all different areas of our built environment, where if it wasn't brought up as a challenge like this, saying, hey, this is important, this is something we need to do, then those innovations don't happen, right? The products don't get developed, and they are, many of them are better than the products they're replacing.
Sure.
Go ahead.
Yeah, no. I would say I feels like every week there's a new concrete admixture coming out to really reduce the carbon in the mix. That I will say, from a structural standpoint, it is a little challenging, because some of these products have to go through this process of getting certified, getting the ASTM numbers and all, and that takes time. So, you know, it's not that we're not open to them, but frankly, when you sign the affidavit, you know, all the products in the building have to have gone through that process for you to feel comfortable to do that. So, you know, it's a little bit of a chicken or the egg, like the structural engineers and the architects are demanding these things. So we're sending market signals out there. They're producing them. They're coming back to us and saying, well, what about this? And then we say, oh, sounds good, but is it, you know, has it gone through the requisite testing and, you know, all the due diligence that needs to happen to make us feel comfortable to put it into a building. Okay. But it's happening quickly. And I really think that, certain companies are responding. You know, here's an example. So there's a product out there that I mentioned, the injection of the CO2 in the mix. And I talked to some local ready mix suppliers about that. And one of them pushed back, but in a way that actually gave me confidence. They said, no, we're doing our own R&D. We're actually going to be producing something better, because they don't want to necessarily use that product. So in a weird way, this I shouldn't say in a weird way, in a good way, there's a competitive aspect of things, yeah. Right? So there, you really, I would say you really want to try to tap into people's type A personalities to make some movement and find, I would honestly say, find your allies, because not everyone's going to be on board. But if you can find a few allies that have the energy and the network, I think that's critically important.
Yeah. The other innovation that's very interesting that I see happening already is software and technology that we're using to design buildings. And right now, what you're talking about is complicated, right? We have to go and look at every single piece of material that we're using and do a calculation and do all of that manually, essentially. I'm seeing tools that are already being developed that are doing these calculations automatically. Eventually, it's going to be part of our design software, where you're designing a building and you're seeing the carbon, you know, output right there in real time as you're developing the building. So you can see how much impact you're having and by clicking a button, reduce it by choosing a different material.
For sure. Yeah, no, that it's a great point. That response has been impressive. A little bit, you know, touch and go, but you're absolutely right. There is
early
software out there. Early. It is in the early phases, but honestly, like also developing quickly. So I don't, you know, I see in a couple of years these to be part of the workflow, you know, regularly.
Yep.
So I think it's a great point. I think from a structural standpoint, you've got to be, the structural engineers need to be coming prepared to look at different systems and not just providing the owner or the CM or whoever's estimating the project early on with the material quantities, but also what is the embodied carbon? Okay. So it's like a third piece of the, of the puzzle. And I think people, I will tell you the structural engineering profession is starting to respond to that. And that's also part of what we're doing with SE 2050.
Yeah. Yeah. Super interesting. I appreciate you coming by and giving us a heads up on this and teaching us at the basic level and what this is and why it's important and some of the things that we can do as small firm architects. So I appreciate you spending some time with us here today. Go ahead.
No, I just want to say I really appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Before we wrap up, I'd like to ask you my final question that I ask everybody. What's one thing that a small firm architect can do today to build a better business for tomorrow?
For better business for tomorrow. I honestly would go back to the success that I've had is again, going back, it might sound simple, but going back and finding your allies, the ones that are going to support you and help you and be on your side and encourage you. I think identifying those people would certainly improve your business in the future.
Very good answer. Michael Grinnick is his name. LeMessurier is the firm. You can learn more about the firm at LeMessurier.com. You can learn more about the commitment program, the SE 2050 commitment program at SE2050.org. We'll have links to that at the show notes, so don't worry about how to spell LeMessurier. It'll be there. SE2050.org is where you can go to learn more about embodied carbon and how to reduce it. If you have a question specifically for Mike, his email is MikeGrinnick@LeMessurier.com. We'll have that link also on the show notes. So just go to the show notes for this episode and there'll be a bunch of resources over there for you. Mike, I appreciate you for all you're doing, your commitment to this specific commitment program, coming by here and sharing your knowledge at Entree Architect Podcast. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark. Really, really appreciate it. Had a lot of fun.
If you liked this episode of Entree Architect Podcast, please share a rating, write a review, and share a link to this episode with a friend. That's how Entree Architect Podcast will grow to serve thousands more architects just like you. Thanks to our sponsors, FreshBooks and RCAT, for their support of this episode. Links to our sponsors and all the resources we discussed today are available at the show notes for this episode found at entrearchitect.com/podcast. Entree Architect is a member of the Gable Media Podcast Network. Gable Media is curated thought leadership for an audience dedicated to building a better world. Listen and subscribe to all the shows at gablemedia.com. That's gablemedia.com. And check out Entree Architect Academy membership. Ready to edit business resources, live monthly business training for architects, a supportive architect community, and Simple Systems, our business system program developed for you, the small firm architect. It's all waiting for you at Entree Architect Academy membership, including AIA Continuing Education Learning Units. Come join me and hundreds of your entrepreneur architect friends at entrearchitect.com/join. Enroll today at entrearchitect.com/join. Thanks for listening today. Love, learn, and share what you know.
From historic homes to modern architecture, brick is one of the most popular building materials around the world.
How to allow the house to bridge the gap between the history of the site, the approachability of this kind of architecture in this kind of neighborhood, and this sort of nostalgia of materiality for the client's past, right? And brick really started to provide an answer for that.
Hi, I'm Doug Pat, and this is Design Vault. There aren't many materials that easily blend with any style and context, but brick does just that. I've seen some extraordinary work with brick. So when Glengarry approached me about hosting this podcast, I couldn't say no.
Typically, Tudor-style houses from outside are just stunningly gorgeous piece of structure. And when you go in, it's just sad.
Yeah.
Dark. And that is not going to happen with my approach to design.
I speak with industry leaders and share inspiring stories behind their work and ingenious design.
You'll see brick that's fashioned into basket weave patterns, sawtooth patterns, what's known in England as diapering.
Doesn't sound like you knew them per se, right? They found you through relationships that you had with other.
Well, wait, Doug, there's more.
Okay.
We'll go behind the scenes to understand process and even the inspiration that sparked the design.
You know, I think we were inspired by all the factory buildings in Dumbo. I mean, that is the kind of period of significance, that early American factory building.
Design Vault by Glenn Gary. Visit glengarry.com/design-vault or search for Design Vault wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe now to stretch your imagination.
Attention architects and creative minds, get ready to supercharge your brand with Build Your Brand, the podcast that's unlocking the secrets of branding success for creatives. Hey there, it's Mark Arlepage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my friend, architect marketing expert, Jeff Eccles at Build Your Brand podcast, where he explores the captivating stories of the world's top brands and transforms their lessons into powerful moves for small firm architects and creatives like you. In season one, Jeff shares the thrilling tale of Southwest Airlines, where he dissects their journey to the summit and distills it into strategies tailor-made for you.
It's important to keep in mind that companies like Southwest compete in the real world, just like you, and face real-world challenges, just like you. You might be surprised at how similar those challenges are to the struggles that you grapple with on a day-to-day basis.
Don't miss out on your blueprint for success. Subscribe, tune in, and let's build your brand together.
You may have noticed that the very best brands in the world are also known for having somewhat unique corporate cultures. That's often the glue that holds everything together when they encounter those rough spots.
We don't do it because it inconveniences the passengers to whom we are primarily dedicated, the short-haul frequent flyer.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Build Your Brand today. Remember, no matter the size, the journey's the same. Your brand's journey to the top starts here.